love the people who protested. I admire them for what they're doing. I just hope they don't go home and forget this vote. They go home and get fired up, organized, and get rid of the scoundrels.
Don Young speaks out against the health care bill. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 22nd of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the case for lowering the cruise ship head tax.
Cruise ships are the faucet that floods this state with passengers.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Association of Alaska School Boards, working with school districts statewide to bring innovation to classrooms through digital learning for the 21st century. Information at aasb.org. And by Wells Fargo, committed to supporting communities and Alaska residents beyond just their banking needs. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
In a historic vote last night, the U.S. House of Representatives passed legislation that will overhaul the nation's health care system. APRN's Libby Casey reports from the Capitol.
34 Democrats sided with Republicans to vote no, but Democratic leadership got three votes more than they needed for passage. Alaska Congressman Don Young joined with all other Republicans in voting against it.
I just think it's too bad for the country if this thing was to be implemented. And I've said all along it's going to be awfully hard to undo what's being done. And now people say, can you repeal it? Well, I think the only way we realistically could repeal it, because Obama will be president for two more years, if we take the majority, would be, in fact, defund them, which we could do, and I think we will do.
House members worked throughout the weekend to either push for or fight the health care bill. Democratic leaders decided not to use a procedural move called deeming, by which they could have deemed the Senate version approved without actually voting on its content. Instead, they led a straight up or down vote on the legislation and a second, smaller bill of changes. Outside the Capitol, thousands of protesters gathered throughout the weekend, the majority angrily against the bill, but also some in favor. They shouted over each other on the Capitol grounds Sunday as the vote neared. The demonstrations reached a tense pitch on Saturday when some Tea Party protesters hurled racial insults at African-American Democratic members of Congress, and reporters present said someone spit on a black congressman. Protesters also shouted anti-gay taunts at Massachusetts Representative Barney Frank. Congressman Young says that behavior was uncalled for, and he didn't witness anything like that. He says on the positive side, he's glad so many Americans were on hand over the weekend to be heard, and he hopes they take action at the polls this fall.
You know, I love the people who protested. I admire them for what they're doing. I just hope they don't go home and forget this vote today. They go home and get fired up, organized, and get rid of the scoundrels.
The final nail-biter came down to a block of anti-abortion Democrats led by Michigan's Bart Stupak, who agreed last night they would vote for the bill once President Obama pledged to sign an executive order saying that long-standing restrictions against using federal funds for abortions will stay in place. Congressman Young says he doesn't buy the president's promise.
The anti-abortion group caved today. I think they're taking an awful risk believing the president when he says he's going to issue an executive order, which has no value, because if he does it, I don't think he will. If he does it, it can be overturned by action of Congress, or it could be overturned by another president. And so what do they gain other than a short reprieve? But that's their business, and I won't tell them what to do, and I don't try to.
President Obama spoke from the White House last night, saying Americans can now know that illness and accidents won't endanger their dreams.
Most importantly, today's vote answers the prayers of every American who has hoped deeply for something to be done about a healthcare system that works for insurance companies but not for ordinary people.
Congressman Young says he supports some elements of healthcare legislation, including banning insurance companies from denying people with pre-existing conditions and letting people enter coverage pools. But he says the Democratic bill goes too far, is too big and costly, and will bog down government.
If the American public decide to buy this program, then we've done our best job here to try to explain it to them. And if we weren't successful, then that's the way the cookie crumbles.
The main bill passed by the House last night now goes to the president for his signature. The smaller reconciliation bill goes to the Senate, which is expected to take it up tomorrow. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Governor Sean Parnell says he thinks the new health care legislation is unconstitutional. But for now, Alaska won't join at least 10 other states who are challenging it. Instead, Parnell says he's asked Attorney General Dan Sullivan to conduct a thorough legal review of the legislation. The Department of Law plans to wade through the 2,100-page bill and look at other legal options, both for and against the reform. Parnell and Sullivan both declined to comment today on the review or the health care bill, but in a statement, Parnell said he worries the legislation could increase the state's Medicaid costs. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius addressed that common concern from states today.
I'm hopeful that once they fully understand what really is in this bill, the fact that the federal government is going to cover 100% of the cost of Medicaid expansion for the first number of years after 2014 is going to help set up a new marketplace for those working families who will be wanting a different kind of insurance choice, that they'll be enthusiastic about this plan.
The Department of Law says there's no timeline for completing the review. In its opening hearing on a bill setting up a university-level scholarship program the governor is sponsoring this year, the House Finance Committee today spent much of its time focusing on the costs and shortfalls of providing the required four-year curriculum that will fall on local school districts. The current plan would require students to earn a minimum grade average of C after 4 years of study in math, language arts, and science, and 3 years of social studies. In smaller schools, that entire course of study is not always available. Education Commissioner Larry Ledoux says he recognizes the problems of delivering the program to smaller school districts, but he says those districts are already successfully using distance education programs.
We find a lot of creativity. What we do find is that some schools offer all 4 years and some schools do not. But what I find common in all schools throughout the state when you ask students what they're going to do when they leave high school, and almost all of them will say, I'm going to college or tech school. They all have the dream. If we continue to create a dream in a child and do not deliver the programming necessary, then we set students up for failure.
Ledoux did not estimate the cost of bringing all schools up to the scholarship standards. Haines Republican Bill Thomas pointed out that it puts small schools at a disadvantage, at least in the early years.
I want to see that this scholarship program starts when everybody is eligible. I don't think we should let other school districts have the advantage over others. This is supposed to be a level playing field, and yeah, I can see us trying to do something, but do it before other people are ready to go forward, I think would be wrong. And that's only again because I come from the rural part of Alaska and I may be disadvantaged.
The bill was held in the committee with no further hearings scheduled. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a big win for the Iditarod's head vet.
It couldn't have made me happier if I'd won the gold medal in the Olympics, I'll tell you. It was a wonderful feeling.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization.
Fish found in the Western Aleutians close to decommissioned military sites have higher levels of contaminants than fish found in other areas of the region. KUCB's Ann Hillman has more.
U.S. Geological Survey wildlife research biologist Keith Miles studied the presence of organochlorines in halibut, cod, and greenlings found near military sites from World War II and the Cold War. Organochlorines, such as PCBs, are highly toxic to all organisms. They used to be used as lubricants for electrical equipment and radars and as pesticides, such as DDT. Miles explains that when the U.S. military set up sites in the Aleutians, they didn't realize that the chemicals were toxic and would persist in the environment for many decades.
At that time, there wasn't a lot of, well, public understanding of just how toxic these compounds are.
Industrial producers did know. Many of the workers in the plants that produced PCBs had skin conditions and internal tumors, but the industry kept the information quiet. In the end, many of the chemicals ended up at remote military sites. When the military decommissioned the sites, they left many things behind.
So the long and short of it is it was probably just dumped because it's a lot cheaper to dump this stuff than it is to haul it back for disposal at a time when you don't have good information.
The problem is, now those toxic compounds are in the environment and are affecting the region's fish and food webs. Miles and his colleagues looked at the presence of organochlorines in three species of fish that are commonly consumed by bald eagles.
What we were investigating was a potential for the transfer through the food web from fish because fish tend to be fatty and organochlorines tend to be stored in fat tissue.
The study tested the livers of fish found around the Western Aleutians near decommissioned military sites and near other islands with no military sites. They found that all of the fish had some contaminants from lightweight organochlorines that traveled through the atmosphere and were deposited in the Aleutians.
You know, Alaska kind of catches it in its shorts because they're not big on agriculture as far as land-based agriculture. But then they have to suffer the consequences of if you get global distillation or global distribution of these chemicals in the environment.
But the fish caught near old military sites had higher levels of heavy organochlorines from the PCBs and other chemicals at those sites. Of the three species tested, halibut had the highest levels. Some fish showed visible signs of contamination.
One of the highly contaminated coves of Adak Island, Sweeper Cove, which was also a Superfund area that was cleaned up. In 1 year, 50% of the fish had tumors or mouth lesions that were very evident.
Miles says the chemicals will persist in the cold Aleutian environment longer than in other climates and could stay in the environment up to 80 or 90 years. He says cleaning them up is necessary in some locations, but not in others. If the contaminants are in areas that are not affected by flooding or other geological or weather conditions, it might be better to leave them than to resuspend them, as was done in Adak. However, at sites like Sweeper Cove on Adak, cleaning them up is necessary because the areas are prone to flooding, which frequently spreads the chemicals and re-exposes other organisms.
And I think that, you know, the take-home message is that we just still have to monitor and be aware that these situations exist out in the environment. And we haven't identified all of them. There's still other places that these chemicals may be sequestered and may rear their ugly head, and we're dealing with a problem again.
The study was published in the International Journal Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry in August 2009. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
A major tourism group is getting behind Governor Sean Parnell's push to cut the cruise ship head tax. But tax authors and some in the legislature are questioning the move. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Paul Landis has been part of Alaska's tourism industry for more than 20 years.
Cruise ships are the faucet that floods this state with passengers. And when they start turning off that faucet, there's a lot of businesses that start to suffer.
Landis is chief operating officer of Siri Alaska Tourism Corporation. The native-owned business runs lodges, day cruises, and other tours from Talkeetna to Seward. He also represents Alaska Alliance for Cruise Travel, which is lobbying for changes in the head tax, also known as the passenger fee. The group worries that fewer ships coming to Alaska this summer is part of a larger industry trend, and he's hoping Governor Sean Parnell's plan to reduce the head tax 25% will bring more ships to the state.
He met with the heads of Carnival Cruise Line, Royal Caribbean, and this is the number that they agreed upon. That's the important piece, is between the cruise line and the governor, that was the magic number that they came to. There was a formula behind that. But it seems to be the right number for both parties.
Parnell announced his plan after being part of the Sea Trade Cruise Show in Miami. It would reduce the tax from $46 to $34.50 per passenger. It would not change an additional $4 per person fee that funds an onboard environmental monitoring program. The governor did not explain the reason for this particular cut amount, but he said the combined $50 head tax is chasing ships away.
That's the largest in the world, I'm told. You know, places like Mexico have $5 or less in terms of a head tax. So
we just seem to be out of sync with the rest of the world here and not competitive. So I am proposing to reduce Alaska's head tax.
The governor also wants further fee reductions for ships stopping in Juneau and Ketchikan, which charge their own head taxes. The Alaska Cruise Association, which represents the industry, did not immediately return calls for comment. The lines have cut three large ships for the upcoming season, reducing passenger loads about 15%. They blame the cuts on the passenger fee and other taxes and regulations mandated by the Cruise Ship Initiative, passed by voters in 2006. Initiative author Joe Geldof of Juneau has negotiated with lawmakers and industry lobbyists about reducing the fee, but he doubts Parnell's plan will go anywhere.
I kind of think at this point in the legislature, this is kind of dramatic politics, but not likely to go anywhere. It's kind of a cunning move by the governor to tell a bunch of people who are whining what they want to hear without any real likelihood of that this will pass.
Geldof says dock construction and other improvements should be completed before the tax is reduced. Revenues are distributed among port communities and other towns affected by tourism. House Minority Leader Beth Kurtula represents downtown Juneau, which saw close to 1 million cruise ship passengers last season. She questions the wisdom of significantly changing a voter-passed initiative, and she says reduced funding could hurt local projects.
Where are we going to take that from? What part of the docks and harbors and the necessary, you know, fixes are we going to do without because of that? You know, this is a huge worldwide industry, and we are very, very welcoming of them. But at the same time, you know, this industry impacts us heavily.
Parnell has not said how he plans to get the tax changed through during the busy final weeks of this year's legislative session. Spokeswoman Sharon Lehouse says he may ask lawmakers to add the change to an existing tourism marketing tax credit bill. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ACS. With Android on ACS, an app is available to listen to NPR programming on your phone. Complete details at acsalaska.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This year's Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race chalked up a record 4 in a row wins for Lance Mackey, but the race made headlines of another kind. For the first time in as long as anyone can remember, no dogs died on the trail. That's good news, considering last year's high of 6 dog deaths. More than 1,000 dogs started the race on March 6th. Reached by cell phone in Nome, the Iditarod's chief veterinarian, Dr. Stuart Nelson, said a zero dog death year is a phenomenal accomplishment on everyone's part.
Everything has to come together just right. There's so many factors out there. We have 1,000 miles, 1,100 dogs, 2 weeks. You know, if you took that number of animals in any population, potentially anything could happen, you know.
He says the victory depended on everyone pulling together.
I'll tell you, when that last team crossed under the Burl Arch and I knew that we were that close and it happened, and I felt like it couldn't have made me happier if I'd won the gold medal in the Olympics, I'll tell you. It was a wonderful feeling.
Nelson says every year race organizers learn more. He said this year there was additional scrutiny of rookie mushers regarding their abilities on the trail. Parents caring for autistic children face challenges anywhere they live, but in rural Alaska, where a child can wander into dangers not faced by urban youngsters, keeping up with the risks can be daunting. One Unalakleet family is dealing with exactly that problem, and they have come up with a unique solution with the help of Iditarod mushers. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Donna Erickson holds down the fort at the Bering Air counter in the tiny but bustling Unalakleet Airport. It's nearing the Iditarod finish, and everyone's trying to get to Nome at once. She's a mother of 5 and is juggling a job at the same time, and she worries about her youngest boy, 10-year-old Logan.
Logan is autistic, and he's nonverbal, and he has a lot of difficulties in his life. One of them is insomnia. He has a hard time sleeping. And another thing is he wanders off. It would be a tracking dog, which would help us when Logan wanders off from the village, either when we're subsistence gathering or he tends to run into the water in the ocean or the river in the summer. He's attracted to water. And this dog would be trained specifically for Logan to help better our lives.
A visit to Unalakleet last year by musher Dee Dee Jonro sparked an idea. Jonro traveled with a pet dog, Mr. Miyagi, which Logan watched with interest. Afterward, Logan said his first word, Miyagi. The connection to the dog triggered something in Logan. Now Jonro and other Iditarod mushers are helping to raise money to buy Logan a service dog, one that will fit his specific needs. The cost? $15,000 or more for the dog and passage to Ohio's Four Paws for Ability for Donna and Logan and for training with the pup.
And there are 14 mushers running for Logan in the Iditarod this year, and they have taken pledges by mile, and then many of the mushers have donated things to an online auction.
Dee Dee Jonro is leading the pack on that effort. She raised money for each mile she traveled in the race, as did other mushers. After checking in at the finish in Nome and kissing her dogs and still out of breath from the trail, it was the first thing she talked about.
And it was an idea that we had in November. And I was up there when there was a big storm and, you know, Donna and Logan and I were evacuated up the mountain, you know, and stayed up the hill with B-Bucks and Ann. And we talked about, gee, you know, for Logan to be able to have life skills, you know, that would be so great for him to have a dog. And so it was just an idea, you know, and that if we could maybe unite that with the Iditarod.
Jonro says the cause could open the way for a whole new way for the Iditarod to give back to Alaska.
I just badly wanted to help, somehow help, and it looks like that we did. His dog has been born, and through the course of this race, his dog has been paid for. And I've personally visualized this as the beginning of a trend to give back to Alaska.
Jonro and Donna Erickson believe that the warmth and affection of a service dog can not only help protect Logan, but provide him with independence and the motivation to communicate. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
In the first half of the 20th century, tuberculosis was a major epidemic in Alaska, and its effects were particularly harsh on rural Native communities. A presentation last week at the Alaska Native Brotherhood Hall addressed that history and also honored some of the era's frontline fighters against TB. For member station KCAW, Ed Ronco has the story.
More than 60 years ago, Marge Ward came to Alaska as a nurse to help tuberculosis patients. On this Tuesday night in March, she's standing inside the Alaska Native Brotherhood Hall in Sitka, looking at old black and white photographs.
And this is Dr. Moore also. I'm not sure who that is.
Ward and five other nurses were recognized during a presentation about the tuberculosis epidemic that swept through Alaska and forever changed communities here, especially Alaska Native communities. In the 1930s, one in three Native deaths came from tuberculosis, and by the 1940s, one in 10 were infected. During the height of the epidemic, 10 times as many Natives died from the disease as did whites. Those statistics come from Linda Green, a professor of anthropology at the University of Arizona. She's writing a book on TB among Yupiks in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, and she shared some of her research at the A&B Hall. She says the tuberculosis epidemic forced Yupiks into hospitals and sanitariums, often far away from home. Green says sometimes when patients died, their families in distant communities didn't hear about it.
Communications were a lot harder.
Brownie Thompson worked as a nurse at Mount Edgecombe Hospital in Sitka from 1949 to 1957.
They always tried to find the family, but when I even came, you had to go through the radio to call down south, you know, like over and out and all that. And the other thing was that the families moved around, like from their fishing camps to hunting. So I think the messages were sent, but there was never a way of knowing if they got to the family.
Green from the University of Arizona is critical of the way U.S. health policy at the time handled Alaska Natives, but she emphasizes that none of that is meant to reflect on individual health care workers. Green says in her interviews with residents around the YK Delta, there was a high regard for the doctors and nurses who worked tirelessly to help tuberculosis patients. And those nurses, like Marge Ward, who was looking at the photographs in the beginning of this story, found very challenging work waiting for them when they arrived.
I had a young patient, a girl in her teens, who could interpret. She was Eskimo. And so I asked her to interpret for me with this new patient, and she couldn't understand. There were 20 dialects in Eskimo. We had no idea that, you know.
When Bethel's hospital burned in 1950, the hospital in Sitka received an urgent message.
And so we got this teletype that said they'd been sending patients out from Bethel. We're sending Edna Jones and 60 more.
The hospital staff frantically prepared the vacant fourth floor to take on a sudden influx of patients. A PBY airplane was already en route.
And we knew when the PBY was coming in. We went down with the ambulance to start getting them off. And this little girl, pretty little girl with pigtails, got off. And then this old gentleman on crutches. And his name was 60 Moore.
Ward came to Sitka in 1949, and she says before then, she had never been west of Utica, New York. And what was supposed to be a brief assignment with the government ended up shaping the rest of her life.
Most of us came on a year's contract, and I always said, well, I came in November, and there was no way I was going back to upstate New York in the Adirondacks in the wintertime. And 1 year leads to another, and you know, 61 years later, you're still here.
Besides Thompson and Ward, the nurses recognized for their service include Marlis Tedeen, Shirley Anderson, and Judy Johnstone. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer in Unalakleet, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Wells Fargo, providing financial tools and resources for purchasing a home or planning for the future. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, schools, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.